I came to understand why the Tibetans or the East Indians spend 3 days in the wilderness, miles away from every human settlement, fasting, praying, and otherwise preparing themselves before they seek to establish a connection with the spirit of a departed person. Certainly not the way thousands of so-called spiritualists, after their work in an office or in the midst of a completely worldly life, gather together and believe they can suddenly be in rapport with the world beyond. They imagine that saying a quick little prayer will protect them from danger. Have they ever been able to observe that saying a prayer can keep a person who jumps into an abyss from falling to his death? Experimenting ignorantly with spiritualism represents just as great a danger as jumping into an abyss. Let us be reasonable. Let us not forget that we have the power of reason in order to check and test all our experiences. During the many years I have spent in the most widely differing groups, I was forced to observe how countless catastrophes, nervous breakdowns, suicides, and serious mental disorders resulted from the irresponsible games people call spiritualism. Well-intentioned, honest but completely ignorant and psychologically unschooled people hold seances. Ignorant people call into being powers whose origin and nature is completely unknown to them. Neither understanding these powers, nor being able to control them, they are completely at their mercy. Only people who are strong enough to resist all influences, have deep psychological knowledge, extensive experience and an enormous conscious willpower and self-control should concern themselves and experiment with spiritualism. I take my vow. Little by little I realized that my circles of spiritualist friends had nothing more to offer me. My experiences in these circles, however, opened the door to the human soul, and I saw in amazement how forlorn and lonely people are as they wander around in the extreme darkness of ignorance. My own ability as a medium enabled me to look into the enormous field of the subconscious. I literally took myself apart in the most rigorous kind of self-analysis, refusing to be blinded by uncertain and nebulous theories. Hewing my way with my little axe, I went ahead in this jungle, step by step. Spiritualism finally led me to the study of psychology. I began to make a thorough study of the Western science of psychology, for at the time I had not the slightest inkling of the enormous psychological knowledge of the Orientals, particularly the Indians and the Chinese. Whenever we earnestly strive for something and concentrate completely on attaining it, fate always helps us onward. After a thorough theoretical training, I met the head physician of the state mental hospital who helped me get systematic training and practice. I was given permission to study the patients in every section of the state asylum, including the wards reserved for raving maniacs. One evening at home I sat for a long time alone in my room and tried to put my thoughts in order. What I had experienced in the asylum was simply horrible. Terrible. Dante's Inferno is tame compared to what I had seen. And how many sick people are there on this earth who are suffering, either committed to an asylum or walking about freely, and how many healthy people are there who suffer themselves because they watch the torture these other people go through. Little by little they get sick and go to ruin. And how many mental cases are there who deceive ignorant people simply because they behave normally and have no stamp on their forehead to show they are mentally ill. Sometimes they get high positions, marry an innocent trusting husband or wife, and then plunge their relatives, their surroundings and family, often an entire business firm, or even an entire nation, into ruin. Hell lay open before my very eyes, and in desperation I stood on the brink of an unfathomable ocean of suffering, desperate at the helplessness of mankind in the face of this terrible misery. Something must be done. Everybody must be informed about the causes of mental disease. Healthy people everywhere must work together with united efforts to fight this misery. My preoccupation with the mentally ill opened the door to the deepest secrets of a wide range of people's families, and I was amazed to discover that there are many more mentally ill than sane people living in the world. I saw the countless mental abnormalities from which people suffer, and I saw that vast numbers of people could be saved by proper treatment, their mental balance could be restored by simple means, often merely by a change of surroundings, thus restoring happiness to the families concerned. I sat and pondered about how much could be done if every healthy person would devote himself to this work. With all my strength, I wanted to devote myself to overcoming this suffering, but how and where should I begin? And where could I find some help? As I sat there asking myself this question, I suddenly knew that somebody was in the room beside me. My experiments with mental telepathy and spiritualistic seances had drained my nerves to such a degree of sensitivity that even if I were led into a room blindfolded, I could say immediately whether the room was empty or occupied. And if the room was occupied, I could even tell something about the character of the person in it. I now felt the familiar prickly feeling, like a fine electric current, telling me that something or somebody was near. But this time I felt the familiar radiation without knowing why it was familiar or where I had met it before. This majestic, completely pure, extremely powerful radiation. And again I heard the familiar voice inside me, "Where will you find some help?" "Inside yourself. Don't you see this is just the trouble? Everybody is waiting for help from outside, and as everybody is expecting help and not giving it, nobody gets help. But if everybody would give help, everybody would receive it too. Then the whole world could be freed of suffering." I answered the voice within, "I don't know who you are or even what kind of a force you are. I only hear your voice that always tells me the truth. You see my thoughts, my inner being, which is invisible to people, so I don't need to tell you. I want to devote my whole life to overcoming the sufferings of others. Even though I be only a grain of dust, with this one grain of dust I want to increase the helping force. Nothing else in life can interest me anymore. Nothing can make me really happy again as long as I constantly carry the sufferings of others in my consciousness. I want to be a co-worker in the salvation of the world." "Careful," said the voice within me. "Watch all those big words. To be a co-worker means duty and sacrifice. Then you have to put an end to your imperfections. You must never forget yourself for even a minute. You must always be on guard that you don't do a single thing in contradiction to the eternal laws of life. All the temptations you haven't been able to withstand so far in your life will come back to haunt you again, and woe to you if you do not withstand them. No mortal can play with the divine forces. You may never again use the powers you achieve as a co-worker for your own personal ends. You may never have personal feelings or consider anything from your own personal standpoint. Be careful. It would be better to go on living your personal life like other people than fail as a co-worker. I warn you. I am not afraid," I answered. "I am absolutely through with my personal life and no longer have any more personal wishes. After all I've been through and experienced, there can be no more personal happiness for me. I'm not afraid of any temptations. I will resist them because I have no more illusions. I want to be a co-worker in the great task." For a while I heard nothing, merely felt infinitely great love radiating towards me. Then I heard the voice within me again, "Your self-assurance is well known to me, my child, but don't forget yourself this time." I sat on the divan, rubbed my brow, looked around. The room was empty. Who was that? Who is that question mark, or what kind of a power is it that speaks to me with a voice I know so well? How do I know this voice? How does it know my self-assurance? And when had I ever not paid enough attention, so as to merit the admonition not to forget myself this time? But I got no further answer. The horizon brightens. Days passed, weeks passed, months passed. I waited for a sign, something that would point the way towards what I should do, towards my duty, towards my sacrifice. In accord with the voice of the invisible one who had spoken to me, but the voice came no more. No matter how often I tried to enter the special state of mind and spirit in which I would feel again the strange and indescribable buzzing and tingling throughout my whole body, as if I were bathing in soda water, no matter how often I tried to close off my organs of sense, to get myself into a state of inner receptivity, ready to hear the voice. It was all to no avail. I was perplexed. I was waiting and waiting for a sign, in vain. On the other hand, I did not want to waste time, so I came to the conclusion that the best thing for me to do would be to carry out my earthly duties as well as possible, hoping all the while that my inner voice would sooner or later tell me what my duty was to be as a co-worker in the great plan. I also felt that I would have to free my soul of every selfish attitude if I wanted to see the truth with perfect clarity, just as a window pane must be clean in order for us to see the sunshine clearly through it. The first step in this direction is to know what is really inside me. As soon as I know my inner self truly, I can cleanse and purify it. I began to investigate the source and inner motivation of all my thoughts, my words, my movements and deeds. What kind of unconscious power is at work within me? Where do my thoughts come from? What is it within me that wills me to say one thing or another? Why do I want to do just this thing, not something else? When I was happy about something, I investigated why I was happy about it. When I was depressed or angry, I sought out the reasons for these feelings. When I felt attracted toward another person or repelled by him, I immediately analyzed myself to discover the characteristics responsible for this feeling. I kept myself under constant observation as to why I liked to do some things and disliked doing others. When I was feeling talkative, I sought to find the reasons and motives behind my loquaciousness. When feeling reserved, I sought the reasons for my taciturnity. I analyzed every word that came out of my mouth to see whether it was completely true, whether it could prove hurtful to no one. I observed the effects of my words and my deeds on others around me. I constantly tried to trade places in my imagination with the person to whom I was speaking. What would I feel if he were saying to me the words I was saying to him? Constantly, uninterruptedly, I kept myself under observation. This everlasting self-scrutiny brought me uncounted riches. Little by little I became acquainted with the magical world of the subconscious and superconscious. I came to recognize the various manifestations of one and the same force, from the lowest urges on up to the highest spiritual self. I came to realize that we have a free choice. We can identify ourselves with our instincts or remain masters of them, that is to say, remain ourselves. I learned that to be a free human being means to control one's instincts and not become the slave of one's passions, desires and wishes. Along with my incessant self-analysis, I continued to study psychology and philosophy, without neglecting my wood-carving or my music. Artistic work provides a wonderful opportunity to turn inward spiritually and to ponder all kinds of questions. Once an art critic was visiting us and saw my furniture that I had carved myself. Over the bed I had hung a faun playing a flute all carved out of wood. The critic asked me whether I had first modeled this figure in clay. I told him I didn't even know how to model in clay and that I had carved it straight out of wood. I simply cut away all the wood that was superfluous, I said. Have you studied anatomy? He asked further. No. I studied music and was not able to attend to colleges at the same time. After scrutinizing my carvings a little while longer, he said, "It's a shame you're not a sculptress. Without training, I would always be a dilettante, and that's just what I wouldn't want to be. But I cannot register at the Art Academy because I don't want to neglect my husband and child." "All right," he said, "I'll talk to the director of the School of Manual Arts. He may perhaps make an exception and permit you to attend the lessons in sculpture without taking all the side courses. You don't need them anyway. I believe it should be possible for you to attend the art school on special terms." In this way, I was able first to attend art school and later to receive training from one of the greatest master sculptors of the time. The first time I reported to him, he came very close to me, peered into my face intently, and said in a very surprised tone, "How interesting. You are the first living person I have ever seen with Egyptian eyes. Did you know you have Egyptian eyes?" "No," I replied, "I don't even know what the difference is between Egyptian eyes and ordinary eyes. The openings of the eyes are slit longitudinally at the side of the eye, and this makes the eyelids rest in a completely different position from those of other races. When you look at a picture, you can tell immediately by this characteristic whether the picture is Egyptian or not. But I never dreamed I would find such eyes in a living person. Present-day Egyptians don't have eyes like this anymore. One only sees them in pictures, just as one can only see the long, drawn-out Egyptian skull formation in pictures and sculptured artifacts. But where did you get these eyes of yours? I smiled politely and said, I just don't know, Professor. Perhaps I am reverting to type. He smiled too, then started me on my work. A year later he entered the studio where I was working. He had several of them all near each other. From now on, he said, I'm not accepting any more tuition from you. If you have no studio of your own, you can work here, but as an independent artist. You no longer need my guidance, only practice in order to get better and better at expressing yourself in this medium. I thanked him for his efforts and for his kind offer. Since I had a large studio at home and had already held several exhibits, I continued my work under my own roof. My professor remained a good friend and dropped in from time to time to see how my work was progressing. The work made me happy, completely happy, even ecstatic. Time, space and the world around me ceased to exist. I felt no physical wishes, hunger or thirst. I even forgot myself completely. I noticed that a force flowed into my nerves while I was concentrating on my work, and that this force exerted a healing influence on mind and body. Many times when I was concentrating on my work and thinking about nothing else, I suddenly recognized a truth which had no relationship whatever with my work. In this way I often received answers to philosophical, psychological or other unsolved problems which had been occupying my mind. In such cases I would stand motionless a moment, my modeling tool in my hand, while my inward eye surveyed the new truth, the new discovery. At such moments I felt as if my head had just poked up through the ceiling of one room and emerged above the floor in an upper room. It was a wonderful feeling to look around with my inward eye in this newly discovered upper room, inspecting all the hidden treasure lying there. These brilliant flashes of inspiration began to come more and more frequently, not only while I was modeling in clay or playing the piano, but almost any time when I was concentrating on something. Once I experienced something very strange. This time, however, it did not occur during my work, but in the late evening just as I was about to drop off to sleep. Our beds were next to each other, and we both had the habit of reading for a little while in bed before falling asleep. On this particular evening we both of us read for a while. Finally I got sleepy, said goodnight to my husband, turned off my reading lamp, stretched, and closed my eyes to go to sleep. I closed my eyes, but I still saw everything in the room. My eyes were closed quite normally, but I was able to see everything, every object, in the room, including my husband lying in his bed next to mine and leafing through his book. I quickly opened my eyes again to see whether my husband really was leafing through his book or whether the whole phenomenon had been the projection from my own imagination. But his motions continued just as I had seen them with my eyes closed. I closed my eyes again but still saw everything. Thus surprised, I sat up in bed again, looked around the room with my eyes closed, and still saw everything quite clearly. Only one thing was very peculiar, namely, that I did not see things in three dimensions, but flat and transparent, just as my eyelids seemed to be transparent like a photographic negative, or like an X-ray picture, but much clearer and more transparent. For example, I saw my sewing machine through its wooden cover, the pictures on the wall in the next room through the closed door, the clothes hanging in the closet, and all my little possessions lying chaotically in my writing desk. The whole picture was like an impression of all the things lying one behind the other. My husband watched for a while as I looked around the room in various directions with my eyes closed. "What are you doing?" he finally asked. All excited, I answered that I was able to see everything in the room with my eyes closed. He became curious and tried several little experiments to find out whether I could see how many fingers he was holding up, and similar things. I was not only able to see his fingers, but even the bones and organs in his body. It was really positively weird, but my sense of humor won the upper hand and I burst out laughing at seeing him so transparent. Finally, we did fall asleep. As usual, I slept peacefully, and the next morning I saw everything quite normally again, and only when my eyes were open. And for quite a long time afterwards, there was no recurrence of this strange phenomenon. I went on with my sculpturing as if nothing had happened. As I continued to work with my modeling tools, I did not neglect my studies in psychology. More and more people came to me to discuss their spiritual problems. In this way I kept on gaining in practical experience. Several years went by in this manner: steady work in the wintertime, family life together on the lake shore amid the beauties of nature in the summer. Visions. There came a period in my life in which I often had visions while perfectly wide awake. Many of them had such a tremendous effect on me and on my later life that I must mention the most important of them. Towards the end of every summer, my husband and I made a journey through various countries. Once, as we were on our way back from Italy, we stopped over in the Dolomites for some mountain climbing. Here I experienced one of the most profoundly impressive visions of my life. One evening, after an exhausting day in the mountains, we returned to a hotel and I lay down. The sun had shone with such intense fierceness during our hiking that it had seemed as if every single ray were a spear aimed straight at my back and my heart. The gigantic reddish rock walls reflected the sunshine in every direction, seeming to magnify it a thousandfold. The whole atmosphere was demonic, everything was glowing with heat as if we were walking in the antechamber of hell. I was really happy when we finally turned towards home, and the sun, which had been burning like a flamethrower, disappeared behind the horizon at last. I went to bed early and stretched out, ready to fall asleep. In this self-same instant I suddenly felt as if the ceiling were falling in on me. As if I were falling into a bottomless abyss. Falling towards instant death. A doctor, summoned at the desperate plea of my husband, found I was suffering from a heart attack. He gave me an injection. The night dragged by, and when morning came my pulse beat was still so weak that it was scarcely discernible. Tortured with a feeling of annihilation, I learned to know what it means to be afraid of death. As was my custom, I observed myself closely, even under those circumstances, discovering that fear of death is a physical condition. In my consciousness there was peace and calm, no fear of death at all, yet I was suffering from such terrible fear of death that I can scarcely find words to express it. It was unbearable. I was no longer completely in this world, and not yet in the next. I was hovering in nothingness, suffering so horribly I thought I would rather die than go on bearing this torture. I gave up the struggle, deciding to go into death knowingly in order to escape from this fear of it. However, just as I wanted to glide over with my consciousness into this nothingness of which I had been so afraid, the space around me suddenly expanded in all directions, and infinity spread out before my astonished eyes. In this infinity, I saw a long, long road winding onward, and at its end, beyond everything material, standing in eternity, the majestic form of a man made of blinding light, his arms stretched out in indescribable love. He seemed infinitely far away from me, and his countenance shone with such an intensely powerful light that it blinded me and I could not see his features. Nevertheless, I recognized him as the savior of the world. On the road, oval beings that looked like eggs were moving forward slowly. As they moved along together, they gave me the impression of so many sheep, viewed from such an angle that only their backs were visible, but not their feet. I stood at the beginning of this road and had to show them the way. They jogged past me slowly in a steady stream, moving in the direction of the figure of light who awaited them with outstretched arms. Those who reached him, entered into his light and disappeared, merging with his resplendent glory. The whole long road was covered with a seemingly endless stream of these oval beings which I recognized as human souls. I showed them the way and kept on pointing out the direction to take, as more and ever more of these souls approached. I began to realize that I was not yet going to die, because I still had this work to do, and that I could not die at all until I had fulfilled this task. I realized, too, that I would be doing this work for a very long time, until my sand in the great cosmic hourglass would run out and I myself would return to my homeland of light wherever radiant love would be awaiting me. Infinite peace came over me, and my heart began to function more normally, even though still weak. I glanced at my husband who was observing me with a worried face. I could move my tongue again a little, and I whispered to him that I was better. The poor dear boy cried like a child out of pure joy that I could speak again and that the light was coming back into my eyes. After another day in bed, I had recovered sufficiently to be able to travel again. A few days more and all was back to normal. During our summertime sojourns at the lake shore, I was almost always more receptive to visions and in a state of greater sensitivity for sending and receiving telepathic messages. Once during our summer vacation we went to bed after a happy day. The house became quiet, and I fell asleep beside my husband. I dreamed all kinds of chaotic, apparently unrelated pictures, and then in my dream I suddenly heard steps. Slow, dragging steps. They caused me to realize that I had dozed off where I was sitting at the top of a long flight of stairs. For a long time there had been no one passing from whom I could beg anything. Now the sound of someone approaching woke me. In a few moments I was quite awake, with my eyes wide open. Then I saw that the slow, dragging steps were those of a very old, broken man who had plodded along painfully to the position I occupied and was now preparing to sit down at the other side of this flight of stairs. These stairs led from where we were, in an elevated corner of the city, down into the center of town below. In the section around us, there were many state and municipal offices, so thousands of people had to go up and down these steps every day. Only now, at midday, is there a short intermission in the otherwise steady stream of people. It's a good place for me to sit. The roof at the entrance of the staircase protects me from rain, and my revenue is good. I have my regular customers who give me alms every day on the way to their offices. But what an impertinence it is for this old beggar to post himself here too. He's bound to do me harm. People going by are not going to give to beggars at once, and so I am certain to lose half of my income. I look at him impatiently and want to tell him to go somewhere else to do his begging. This is my place and it's up to him to clear out. I look at him and an uncertain feeling grips me. I peer into his eyes and suddenly feel uneasy. I see that he too is embarrassed. He makes a movement as if to run away, but it is too late. I recognize him, and he recognizes me. O Father of Mercy, it is he. Here is the man I have been seeking all my life, the man who abandoned me, the man I could never forget. And now he is sitting opposite me, a beggar just like myself. Oh why do we have to meet again like this? I look at him, his wrinkled old face, and his skin. His lips hang loose and limp, his thin, matted hair and his beard are neglected, his clothing consists of old, worn-out rags. What has become of the handsome, elegant young cavalier he was once? He looks at me in pain and anguish, conscious of his debt. Ashamed. His old, wrinkled face contorts. His weak and flabby lips droop downward, and he begins to cry in silence. He reaches upward to wipe away his tears, and so I see his hands covered with brittle skin, cracked and full of wounds, his long, dirty fingernails, his stiff, neglected, revolting, gouty fingers. Oh, these hands that were once so beautiful, so elegant, so well cared for. These hands I was once so happy to kiss. Then I look at my hands. Oh horrors! They are just as old and neglected as his. When I raise them up, I see my own fingers bent and knotted with gout, The skin of my hands cracked and bloody in thousands of places. Since when have my hands become so horrible, so revolting? I do not know. I have never thought of observing myself. I have been living like a sleepwalker. Now, as if coming out of a stupor, I begin to remember.